Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Well, hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us. I cannot tell you how excited I am to have this opportunity to talk to one of my favorite writers in the world, the extraordinary Isabel Wilkerson. I've been so jazzed about this moment, and of course, reading Cast for me has just been, we've already had a really great conversation before y'all could join. We were talking, and I just was talking about how therapeutic it is. So I'm thrilled to be here. And I want to start, Isabel, by just asking, like, what is this like? Cast has already been declared an American classic. And I think it's generating a lot of excitement. It's praise that is well deserved. I'm just going to put it out there. It should win every major book award in America. You know, I think of you as a kind of chef who takes her time and doesn't put her delights out until she's ready. And I know Random House has been sweating you. When is the book going to? Because they probably wanted a book 6 years ago. The fact that you took your time and you have crafted something that is absolutely extraordinary. But I want to begin by this. Is it a relief to see all of these great reviews and to have this great response, or are you just indifferent to it? You're going to speak your truth. You're not worried about what people say. How does it feel in this moment?
Well, you know, I spent so much time on my book that I don't even, I can't even imagine being at this moment. I spend more time in the book than this part of it. Like, this part is just like a little blip. You know, Warmth of the Suns was 15 years. So I often say if it was a human being, it would be in high school and dating. That's how long it took me to finish that book. So the vast majority of my time is in the process of creating. So this is just a continuum, and there, so much is happening in terms of how we're managing in COVID-19 and all the additional things that it's hard to process. And all, so much is virtual anyway, that's really hard to process. But yeah, I'm thrilled that people are reading it. It's really important to me that people read it, because there's a lot in it, as you know.
Yeah. Well, a lot of us are really excited for you, because we're just energized that people are going to encounter this really remarkable dissection of so much about our experience that I don't think has been addressed. And I guess I wanted to start with that. You know, you're a renowned journalist. You seem to have developed an interest in journalism early on. I know you were involved in journalism as a high school student.
Yeah.
And you went to Howard and became the editor-in-chief of that really well-respected campus newspaper, and then got all of these opportunities, of course, the first Black woman to win a Pulitzer Prize with the New York Times. When I read Cast, I think of it as a masterwork in sociology. I can't imagine any sociology student in the next 30 years being able to graduate without reading this book, because you do something so remarkable in this intersection. Of course, it's African American studies, and of course, it's history, but it's also this really deft use of sociology. And I guess I'm just curious where that started. Did you always have this kind of interest in the sociology of race that's been with you a long time? Or did you develop this idea, you know, more recently and just were looking for some other way to explain and articulate these concerns?
Well, you know, I specialize in narrative nonfiction. So in order to tell a story, you have to call upon all disciplines that are at your disposal, you know, sociology, anthropology, history, psychology, economics, literature, whatever is necessary in order to tell the story. And of course, I spend a lot of time normally doing a lot of ethnography, spending time with people, getting to really spend time to know and feel what they're feeling and what their experience has been. You know, I often say that narrative nonfiction is the closest that you get to being another person, which is what I specialized in and focus on with Warmth of the Suns. And it was Warmth of the Suns that led to this book, because in that book, in Warmth of the Suns, people may not realize that, you know, in writing about 6 million people who were fleeing the Jim Crow South, leaving a place where it was actually against law for a Black person and a white person to merely play checkers together. There were separate segregated Bibles. I mean, almost anything that could be segregated was. that when I was describing that, I realized that racism was not the most sufficient word to describe what they were leaving. It was deeper and bigger and more, there's something almost primordial about it that was beyond just simply not liking someone. And that's not all that racism is, but that element of emotion was not the only thing there. And so I began using the word caste with that book. The Warmth of the Suns does not have racism in it. It uses the word caste system. And that's what led me to this book. And I should probably take the time to say what caste is. Caste is essentially an artificial, arbitrary, often random, graded ranking of human value in a society. And it's what determines one's standing and respect, benefit of the doubt, access to resources, assumptions of intelligence and beauty even, all of those things that are accorded people or withdrawn from people based upon where they are perceived to be in the caste system. And the American caste system, of course, you know, began with the arrival of the colonists here, Virginia, and with the arrival also of the enslaved people to build the land, to build a country for free, and it went on for 246 years. So those were the origins of our hierarchy here in this country. And this is an effort to try to understand that and see how we still live under the shadow of that to this day.
Under the shadow of that. Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade leaping from the shadows. Today's date, Thursday, September 17, 2020. So I have been told that this is our counter-racist book club, our second installment, the lovely Isabel Wilkerson's Cased, The Origins of Our Discontents. This is our second installment, the audio section that you just heard. That is the lovely Isabel Wilkerson and Brian Stevenson. He is an attorney, has done a lot of spectacular work getting black people who have been wrongly convicted released from prison. He also was a big part of getting the Museum to Lynching constructed in Alabama. I think at least one or two of our listeners have visited before the Rona. Anyway, they did a interview about her book that just came out a few weeks ago. I thought it was fascinating for a number of reasons. I can only say again, woo, Gus T. Renegade, the conclusions that I have come to about racism, white supremacy, the vast majority of non-white people do not agree with me, and it's not like we have a close answer. If I could use the metaphor, if this was mathematics, my answer is 5,000,002. All the other students in class, non-white, their answer is negative 8,000,011. Like, whoa, we don't just have different answers. We have like spectacularly different conclusions, which is fine. Victims guaranteed qualified. I just like to make sure that I point that out. It could be that Gus T. Renegade is astronomically incorrect about white supremacy, racism, what it is, and how it works. Or, this problem is massive. I bring that up because at this moment, much like 2015 and many other times, many people are saying, wow, I want to really study and learn more about racism, white supremacy. I'm tired of seeing black people die in the streets and protest and all this. I want to get a better understanding of what this thing racism is and how it works. I've had people contact me and say that, you know, are there any books you can recommend? That sort of thing. I'm sure you all have as well. If there is a non-white person, 20 years old, 25 years old, going to get a book to learn about racism, and they got those book lists, right, that say, hey, these are 9 or 10 books to read if you want to learn and know about racism, white supremacy. I haven't seen like the ISIS papers or Yorugu on any of those lists, even medical apartheid. But they'll put Cased on that list, just published this year. If a non-white person, 25 years old, sitting down for the first time saying, I want to learn and study about white supremacy, racism, what it is and how it works, do I think they would get accurate information from this book? That's something to think about as we proceed. That's something that I think we should think about in evaluating any book, because I have concluded white people, racist white supremacists, they deliberately publish a lot of books on racism that are totally inaccurate. There is not a shortage of books about racism. Anybody that's gone, I mean, you can go to the most rinky-dink library in the world. You know, bookshelves are falling off, and they don't have Wi-Fi, and the stapler is broken, and all. They will have books on racism, guaranteed. Like, there is not a, we might have a shortage on toilet paper and a whole lot of things, Rona testing kits. We don't have a shortage on books on racism, and got more of them coming. You ever run out of toilet paper? Books on racism. However, what did I say before? I looked at my photos on the wall, my bookshelf, one of my bookshelves. I counted about approximately 150 books all about racism. Racism is in the title of exactly 4 books. That's less than 4%. And then we end up with people who brag about not including racism in the book. That's one that generally stands out, because people will, that is very common, what you just heard in that segment, where people will brag, boast, give long, verbose explanations for not saying racism, when that is exactly what they are talking about. That is generally something that strikes me as being suspicious, and I tend to think we are going to be moving away from talking accurately about the problem. One other thing, many of the people, non-white people, who talk about racism, talk around racism sometimes, do not think this problem can be solved. That is important. That is something I would encourage folks to pay attention to. Many people do not think that the problem of racism can be solved. You can just talk about it. If you don't think the problem can be solved, oftentimes that will hugely impact the language, how you articulate your views on the subject matter, if you don't really think the problem can be solved. Just something to be mindful of as we kind of move along through the text. Last thing I'll point out, Bryan Stevenson, he was talking about how long Isabel Wilkerson takes to craft her works. And she shared, I said it last week, she spent 15 years crafting The Warmth of Other Suns, and it shows. It is amazing. In my top 10 for a reason. She did not divulge how long she spent working on this book. She had a moment of pride, and I would too, like, stand by your work, 15 years, bam. She didn't have that share of pride about how long she spent working on this book, which is what I said last week. And Bryan Stevenson, he corroborated what I said last week. They do, white people, do move up publishing dates for books. He said, I bet they've been asking for a book from you for years now. They know you get book lists. You have people who want to read about racism when you have these type of moments. I said last week they moved up Ta-Nehisi Coates, Between the World and Me. They moved the publication of that book earlier because of the police terrorism and protests that were happening. White people sometimes publish books. White people often publish books that are not accurate about racism. Just things to keep in mind as we proceed. Context of White Supremacy. This is Isabel Wilkerson's Cased, The Origins of Our Discontents. Audio segment 1.
Part 2. The Arbitrary Construction of Human Divisions. Chapter 4. A Long-Running Play and the Emergence of Caste in America. Day after day, the curtain rises on a stage of epic proportions, one that has been running for centuries. The actors wear the costumes of their predecessors and inhabit the roles assigned to them. The people in these roles are not the characters they play, but they have played the roles long enough to incorporate the roles into their very being, to merge the assignment with their inner selves and how they are seen in the world. The costumes were handed out at birth and can never be removed. The costumes cue everyone in the cast to the roles each character is to play and to each character's place on the stage. Over the run of the show, the cast has grown accustomed to who plays which part. For generations, everyone has known who is center stage in the lead. Everyone knows who the hero is, who the supporting characters are, who is the sidekick, good for laughs, and who is in shadow. The undifferentiated chorus with no lines to speak, no voice to sing, but necessary for the production to work. The roles become sufficiently embedded into the identity of the players that the leading man or woman would not be expected so much as to know the names or take notice of the people in the back, and there would be no need for them to do so. Stay in the roles long enough, and everyone begins to believe that the roles are preordained, that each cast member is best suited by talent and temperament for their assigned role, and maybe for only that role, that they belong there and were meant to be cast as they are currently seen. The cast members become associated with their characters, typecast, locked into either inflated or disfavored assumptions. They become their characters. As an actor, you are to move the way you are directed to move, speak the way your character is expected to speak. You are not yourself. You are not to be yourself. Stick to the script and to the part you are cast to play, and you will be rewarded. Veer from the script, and you will face the consequences. Veer from the script, and other cast members will step in to remind you where you went off script. Do it often enough, or at a critical moment, and you may be fired, demoted, cast out, your character conveniently killed off in the plot. The social pyramid known as a cast system is not identical to the cast in a play, though the similarity in the two words hints at a tantalizing intersection. When we are cast into roles, we are not ourselves. We are not supposed to be ourselves. We are performing based on our place in the production, not necessarily on who we are inside. We are all players on a stage that was built long before our ancestors arrived in this land. We are the latest cast in a long-running drama that premiered on this soil in the early 17th century. It was in late August 1619, a year before the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock, that a Dutch man of war set anchor at the mouth of the James River at Point Comfort, in the wilderness of what is now known as Virginia. We know this only because of a haphazard line in a letter written by the early settler John Rolfe. This is the oldest surviving reference to Africans in the English colonies in America, people who looked different from the colonists and who would ultimately be assigned by law to the bottom of an emerging caste system. Rolfe mentions them as merchandise, and not necessarily the merchandise the English settlers had been expecting. The ship brought not anything but 20 and odd Negroes, Rolfe wrote, which the governor and Cape Marchant bought for victuals. These Africans had been captured from a slave ship bound for the Spanish colonies, but were sold farther north to the British. Historians do not agree on what their status was, if they were bound in the short term for indentured servitude or relegated immediately to the status of lifetime enslavement, the condition that would befall most every human who looked like them arriving on these shores or born here for the next quarter millennium. The few surviving records from the time of their arrival show they held at the outset a singularly debased status in the eyes of white Virginians, wrote the historian Alden T. Vaughan. If not yet consigned formally to permanent enslavement, black Virginians were at least well on their way to such a condition. In the decades to follow, colonial laws herded European workers and African workers into separate and unequal queues and set in motion the caste system that would become the cornerstone of the social, political, and economic system in America. This caste system would trigger the deadliest war on U.S. soil, lead to the ritual killings of thousands of subordinate caste people in lynchings, and become the source of inequalities that becloud and destabilize the country to this day. With the first rough attempts at a colonial census conducted in Virginia in 1630, a hierarchy began to form. Few Africans were seen as significant enough to be listed in the census by name, as would be the case for the generations to follow, in contrast to the majority of European inhabitants, indentured or not. The Africans were not cited by age or arrival date, as were the Europeans. Information vital to setting the terms and time frame of indenture for Europeans, or for Africans, had they been in the same category, been seen as equal, or seen as needing to be accurately accounted for. Thus, before there was a United States of America, there was the caste system born in colonial Virginia. At first, religion, not race as we now know it, defined the status of people in the colonies. Christianity, as a proxy for Europeans, generally exempted European workers from lifetime enslavement. This initial distinction is what condemned first indigenous people and then Africans, most of whom were not Christian upon arrival, to the lowest rung of an emerging hierarchy before the concept of race had congealed to justify their eventual and total debasement. The creation of a caste system was a process of testing the bounds of human categories and not the result of a single edict. It was a decades-long sharpening of lines whenever the colonists had a decision to make. When Africans began converting to Christianity, they posed a challenge to a religion-based hierarchy. Their efforts to claim full participation in the colonies was in direct opposition to the European hunger for the cheapest, most pliant labor to extract the most wealth from the New World. The strengths of African workers became their undoing. British colonists in the West Indies, for example, saw Africans as a civilized and relatively docile population who were accustomed to discipline and who cooperated well on a given task. Africans demonstrated an immunity to European diseases, making them more viable to the colonists than were the indigenous people the Europeans had originally tried to enslave. More pressingly, the colonies of the Chesapeake were faltering and needed manpower to cultivate tobacco. The colonies farther south were suited for sugarcane, rice, and cotton, crops with which the English had little experience, but that Africans had either cultivated in their native lands or were quick to master. The colonists soon realized that without Africans and the skills that they brought, their enterprises would fail, wrote the anthropologists Audrey and Brian Smedley. In the eyes of the European colonists and to the Africans' tragic disadvantage, they happened to bear an inadvertent birthmark over their entire bodies that should have been nothing more than a neutral variation in human appearance, but which made them stand out from the English and Irish indentured servants. The Europeans could and did escape from their masters and blend into the general white population that was hardening into a single caste. The Gaelic insurrections caused the English to seek to replace this source of servile labor entirely with another source, African slaves, the Smedleys wrote. The colonists had been unable to enslave the native population on its own turf and believed themselves to have solved the labor problem with the Africans they imported. With little further use for the original inhabitants, the colonists began to exile them from their ancestral lands and from the emerging caste system. This left Africans firmly at the bottom, and by the late 1600s, Africans were not merely slaves, There were hostages subjected to unspeakable tortures that their captors documented without remorse. And there was no one on the planet willing to pay a ransom for their rescue. Americans are loath to talk about enslavement, in part because what little we know about it goes against our perception of our country as a just and enlightened nation, a beacon of democracy for the world. Slavery is commonly dismissed as a sad, dark chapter in the country's history. It is as if the greater the distance we can create between slavery and ourselves, the better to stave off the guilt or shame it induces. But in the same way that individuals cannot move forward, become whole and healthy, unless they examine the domestic violence they witnessed as children, or the alcoholism that runs in their family, the country cannot become whole until it confronts what was not a chapter in its history, but the basis of its economic and social order. For a quarter millennium, slavery was the country. Slavery was a part of everyday life, a spectacle that public officials and European visitors to the slaving provinces could not help but comment on with curiosity and revulsion. In a speech in the House of Representatives, a 19th century congressman from Ohio lamented that on the beautiful avenue in front of the Capitol, members of Congress during this session have been compelled to turn aside from their path to permit a coffle of slaves, males and females chained to each other by their necks, to pass on their way to this national slave market. The Secretary of the U.S. Navy expressed horror at the sight of barefoot men and women locked together with the weight of an ox chain in the beating sun, forced to walk the distance to damnation in a state farther south, and riding behind them a white man on horseback carrying pistols in his belt, and who, as we passed him, had the impudence to look us in the face without blushing. The Navy official, James K. Paulding, said, "When they, the slaveholders, permit such flagrant and indecent outrages upon humanity as that I have described, when they sanction a villain in thus marching half-naked men and women loaded with chains without being charged with a crime but that of being black, from one section of the United States to another, hundreds of miles in the face of day, they disgrace themselves and the country to which they belong." Slavery in this land was not merely an unfortunate thing that happened to black people. It was an American innovation, an American institution created by and for the benefit of the elites of the dominant caste, and enforced by poorer members of the dominant caste who tied their lot to the caste system rather than to their consciences. It made lords of everyone in the dominant caste, as law and custom stated that submission is required of the slave, not to the will of the master only, but to the will of all other white persons. It was not merely a torn thread in an otherwise perfect cloth, wrote the sociologist Steven Steinberg. It would be closer to say that slavery provided the fabric out of which the cloth was made. American slavery, which lasted from 1619 to 1865, was not the slavery of ancient Greece or the illicit sex slavery of today. The abhorrent slavery of today is unreservedly illegal. And any current-day victim who escapes, escapes to a world that recognizes her freedom and will work to punish her enslaver. American slavery, by contrast, was legal and sanctioned by the state and a web of enforcers. Any victim who managed to escape, escaped to a world that not only did not recognize her freedom, but would return her to her captors for further unspeakable horrors as retribution. In American slavery, the victims, not the enslavers, were punished, subject to whatever atrocities the enslaver could devise as a lesson to others. What the colonists created was an extreme form of slavery that had existed nowhere in the world, wrote the legal historian Ariella J. Gross. For the first time in history, one category of humanity was ruled out of the human race and into a separate subgroup that was to remain enslaved for generations in perpetuity. The institution of slavery was, for a quarter millennium, the conversion of human beings into currency, into machines who existed solely for the profit of their owners, to be worked as long as the owners desired, who had no rights over their bodies or loved ones, who could be mortgaged, bred, won in a bet, given as wedding presents, bequeathed to heirs, sold away from spouses or children to cover an owner's debt, or to spite a rival, or to settle an estate. They were regularly whipped, raped, and branded, subjected to any whim or distemper of the people who owned them. Some were castrated or endured other tortures too grisly to be mentioned here, tortures that the Geneva Conventions would have banned as war crimes had the conventions applied to people of African descent on this soil. Before there was a United States of America, there was enslavement. Theirs was a living death passed down for 12 generations. The slave is doomed to toil that others may reap the fruits, is how a letter writer identifying himself as Judge Ruffin testified to what he saw in the Deep South. The slave is entirely subject to the will of his master, wrote William Goodell, a minister who chronicled the institution of slavery in the 1830s. What he chooses to inflict upon him, he must suffer. He must never lift a hand in self-defense. He must utter no word of remonstrance. He has no protection and no redress, fewer than the animals of the field. They were seen as not capable of being injured, Goodell wrote. They may be punished at the discretion of their lord, or even put to death by his authority. As a window into their exploitation, consider that in 1740, South Carolina, like other slaveholding states, finally decided to limit the workday of enslaved African Americans to 15 hours from March to September, and to 14 hours from September to March, double the normal workday for humans who actually get paid for their labor. In that same era, prisoners found guilty of actual crimes were kept to a maximum of 10 hours per workday. Let no one say that African Americans as a group have not worked for our country. For the ceaseless exertions of their waking hours, many subsisted on a peck of corn a week, which they had to mill by hand at night after their labors in the field. Some owners denied them even that as punishment and allowed meat for protein only once a year. They were scarcely permitted to pick up crumbs that fell from their master's tables, George Whitefield wrote. Stealing food was a crime punished by flogging. Your slaves, I believe, work as hard, if not harder, than the horses whereon you ride, Whitefield wrote in an open letter to the colonies of the Chesapeake in 1739. These, after their work is done, are fed and taken proper care of. Enslavers bore down on their hostages to extract the most profit, whipping those who fell short of impossible targets, and whipping all the harder those who exceeded them, to wring more from their exhausted bodies. Whipping was a gateway form of violence that led to bizarrely creative levels of sadism, wrote the historian Edward Baptist. Enslavers used every modern method of torture, he observed, from mutilation to waterboarding. Slavery made the enslavers among the richest people in the world, granting them the ability to turn a person into cash at the shortest possible notice. But from the time of enslavement, Southerners minimized the horrors they inflicted and to which they had grown accustomed. No one was willing, Baptist wrote, to admit that they lived in an economy whose bottom gear was torture. The vast majority of African Americans who lived in this land in the first 246 years of what is now the United States lived under the terror of people who had absolute power over their bodies and their very breath, subject to people who faced no sanction for any atrocity they could conjure. "This fact is of great significance for the understanding of racial conflict," wrote the sociologist Guy B. Johnson, "for it means that white people during the long period of slavery became accustomed to the idea of regulating Negro insolence and insubordination by force, with the consent and approval of the law. Slavery so perverted the balance of power that it made the degradation of the subordinate caste seem normal and righteous. In the gentlest houses drifted now and then the sound of dragging chains and shackles, the bay of the hounds, the report of pistols on the trail of the runaway," wrote the Southern writer Wilbur J. Cash. "And as the advertisements of the time incontestably prove, mutilation and the mark of the branding iron. The most respected and beneficent of society people oversaw forced labor camps that were politely called plantations, concentrated with hundreds of unprotected prisoners whose crime was that they were born with dark skin. Good and loving mothers and fathers, pillars of their communities, personally inflicted gruesome tortures upon their fellow human beings. For the horrors of the American Negro's life," wrote James Baldwin, "there has been almost no language. This was what the United States was, for longer than it was not. It is a measure of how long enslavement lasted in the United States that the year 2022 marks the first year that the United States will have been an independent nation for as long as slavery lasted on its soil. No current day adult will be alive in the year in which African Americans as a group will have been free for as long as they had been enslaved. That will not come until the year 2111. It would take a civil war, the deaths of 750,000 soldiers and civilians, the assassination of a president, Abraham Lincoln, and the passage of the 13th Amendment to bring the institution of enslavement in the United States of America to an end. For a brief window of time, the 12 years known as Reconstruction, the North sought to rebuild the South and help the 4 million people who had been newly liberated. But the federal government withdrew for political expediency in 1877 and left those in the subordinate caste in the hands of the very people who had enslaved them. Now, nursing resentments from defeat in the war, people in the dominant caste took out their hostilities on the subordinate caste with fresh tortures and violence to restore their sovereignty in a reconstituted caste system. The dominant caste devised a labyrinth of laws to hold the newly freed people on the bottom rung ever more tightly, while a popular new pseudoscience called eugenics worked to justify the renewed debasement. People on the bottom rung could be beaten or killed with impunity for any breach of the caste system, like not stepping off the sidewalk fast enough, or trying to vote. The colonists made decisions that created the caste system long before the arrival of the ancestors of the majority of people who now identify as Americans. The dominant caste controlled all resources, controlled whether, when, and if a black person would eat, sleep, reproduce, or live. The colonists created a caste of people who would, by definition, be seen as dumb because it was illegal to teach them to read or write, as lazy to justify the bullwhip, as immoral to justify rape and forced breeding, as criminal because the colonists made the natural response to kidnap, floggings, and torture the human impulse to defend oneself or break free, a crime if one were black. Thus, each new immigrant, the ancestors of most current-day Americans, walked into a pre-existing hierarchy, bipolar in construction, arising from slavery, and pitting the extremes in human pigmentation at opposite ends. Each new immigrant had to figure out how and where to position themselves in the hierarchy of their adopted new land. Oppressed people from around the world, particularly from Europe, passed through Ellis Island, shed their old selves and often their old names to gain admittance to the powerful dominant majority. Somewhere in the journey, Europeans became something they had never been or needed to be before. They went from being Czech or Hungarian or Polish to white, a political designation that only has meaning when set against something not white. They would join a new creation, an umbrella category for anyone who entered the new world from Europe. Germans gained acceptance as part of the dominant caste in the 1840s, according to immigration and legal scholar Ian Haney Lopez, the Irish in the 1850s to 1880s, and the Eastern and Southern Europeans in the early 20th century. It was in becoming American that they became white. In Ireland or Italy, Lopez wrote, whatever social or racial identities these people might have possessed, being white wasn't one of them. Serbs and Albanians, Swedes and Russians, Turks and Bulgarians, who might have been at war with one another back in their mother countries, were fused together on the basis not of a shared ethnic culture or language or faith or national origin, but solely on the basis of what they looked like, in order to strengthen the dominant caste in the hierarchy. No one was white before he, she came to America, James Baldwin once said. Their geographic origin was their passport to the dominant caste. The European immigrants' experience was decisively shaped by their entering an arena where Europeanness, that is to say whiteness, was among the most important possessions one could lay claim to, wrote the Yale historian Matthew Fry Jacobson. It was their whiteness, not any kind of New World magnanimity, that opened the golden door. To gain acceptance, each fresh infusion of immigrants had to enter into a silent, unspoken pact of separating and distancing themselves from the established lowest caste. Becoming white meant defining themselves as furthest from its opposite, black. They could establish their new status by observing how the lowest caste was regarded and imitating or one-upping the disdain and contempt, learning the epithets, joining in on violence against them to prove themselves worthy of admittance to the dominant caste. They might have arrived as neutral innocents, but would have been forced to choose sides if they were to survive in their adopted land. Here they had to learn how to be white. Thus, Irish immigrants, who would not have had anything against any one group upon arrival and were escaping famine and persecution of their own under the British, were pitted against black residents when they were drafted to fight a war over slavery from which they did not benefit and that they did not cause. Unable to attack the white elites who were sending them to war and who had prohibited black men from enlisting, Irish immigrants turned their frustration and rage against the scapegoats who they by now knew were beneath them in the American hierarchy. They hung black men from lamp poles and burned to the ground anything associated with black people. Homes, businesses, churches, a black orphanage in the draft riots of 1863, considered the largest race riot in American history. A century later, and in living memory, some 4,000 Italian and Polish immigrants went on a rampage when a black veteran tried to move his family into the all-white suburb of Cicero, Illinois, in 1951. Hostility toward the lowest caste became part of the initiation rite into citizenship in America. Thus, people who had descended from Africans became the unifying foil in solidifying the caste system, the bar against which all others could measure themselves approvingly. It was not just that various white immigrant groups' economic successes came at the expense of non-whites, Jacobson wrote, but that they owe their now stabilized and broadly recognized whiteness itself in part to those non-white groups. The institution of slavery created a crippling distortion of human relationships, where people on one side were made to perform the role of subservience and to sublimate whatever innate talents or intelligence they might have had. They had to suppress their grief over the loss of children or spouses whose bodies had not died, but in a way had died because they had been torn from them, never to be seen again, and at the hands of the very people they were forced to depend upon for their very breath. The reward for all this being that they might not be whipped that day, or their remaining son or daughter might not be taken from them this time. On the other side, the dominant caste lived under the illusion of an innate superiority over all other groups of humans, told themselves that the people they forced to work for up to 18 hours without the pay that anyone had a right to expect were not, in fact, people, but beasts of the field, childlike creatures, not men, not women, that the performance of servility that had been flogged out of them arose from genuine respect and admiration for their innate glory. These disfigured relationships were handed down through the generations. The people whose ancestors had put them atop the hierarchy grew accustomed to the unearned deference from the subjugated group and came to expect it. They told themselves that the people beneath them did not feel pain or heartache, were debased machines that only looked human and upon whom one could inflict any atrocity. The people who told themselves these things were telling lies to themselves. Their lives were to some degree a lie, and in dehumanizing these people whom they regarded as beasts of the field, they dehumanized themselves. Americans of today have inherited these distorted rules of engagement, whether or not their families had enslaved people or had even been in the United States. Slavery built the man-made chasm between blacks and whites that forces the middle castes of Asians, Latinos, indigenous people, and new immigrants of African descent to navigate within what began as a bipolar hierarchy. Newcomers learned to vie for the good favor of the dominant caste and to distance themselves from the bottom dwellers, as if everyone were in the grip of an invisible playwright. They learn to conform to the dictates of the ruling caste if they are to prosper in their new land, a shortcut being to contrast themselves with the degraded lowest caste, to use them as the historic foil against which to rise in a harsh, every-man-for-himself economy. By the late 1930s, as war and authoritarianism were brewing in Europe, the caste system in America was fully in force and into its third century. Its operating principles were evident all over the country, but caste was enforced without quarter in the authoritarian Jim Crow regime of the former Confederacy. Caste in the South, wrote the anthropologists W. Lloyd Warner and Allison Davis, is a system for arbitrarily defining the status of all Negroes and of all whites with regard to the most fundamental privileges and opportunities of human society. It would become the social, economic, and psychological template at work in one degree or another for generations. A few years ago, a Nigerian-born playwright came to a talk that I gave at the British Library in London. She was intrigued by the lecture, the idea that 6 million African Americans had had to seek political asylum within the borders of their own country during the Great Migration, a history that she had not known of. She talked with me afterward and said something that I have never forgotten, that startled me in its simplicity. "You know that there are no black people in Africa," she said. "Most Americans, weaned on the myth of drawable lines between human beings, have to sit with that statement. It sounds nonsensical to our ears. Of course there are black people in Africa. There is a whole continent of black people in Africa. How could anyone not see that?" "Africans are not black," she said. "They are Igbo and Yoruba, Ewe, Akan, and Debele. They are not black. They are just themselves. They are humans on the land. That is how they see themselves, and that is who they are. What we take as gospel in American culture is alien to them," she said. "They don't become black until they go to America or come to the UK," she said. "It is then that they become black. It was in the making of the New World that Europeans became white, Africans black, and everyone else yellow, red, or brown. It was in the making of the New World that humans were set apart on the basis of what they looked like, identified solely in contrast to one another, and ranked to form a caste system based on a new concept called race. It was in the process of ranking that we were all cast into assigned roles to meet the needs of the larger production. None of us are ourselves." Chapter 5, The Container We Have Built For You. Her name is Miss. It is only Miss. It is Miss for a reason. She was born in Texas in the 1970s to parents who came of age under Jim Crow, the authoritarian regime that laid the ground rules for the rest of a willing country. The overarching rule was that the lowest caste was to remain low in every way at all times, at any cost. Every reference was intended to reinforce their inferiority. In describing a train wreck, for instance, newspapers would report, "Two men and two women were killed, and four Negroes." Black men were never to be addressed as Mr., and black women were never to be addressed as Miss or Mrs., but rather by their first name or auntie or gal, regardless of their age or marital status. These rules were as basic as the change in the seasons, and a mayoral campaign in Birmingham, Alabama, turned almost entirely on a breach of a sacrosanct protocol. The supremacist police chief, Bull Connor, had a favorite in that 1961 race. He decided to secure the election of the man he wanted to win by framing the man he wanted to lose. He paid a black man to shake the opposing candidate's hand in public as a photographer lay in wait. The story took up a full page in a local newspaper, and the opponent lost the election, as Bull Connor knew he would. For white Southerners, it was a cardinal sin. It was harrowing, wrote the historian Jason Sokol, to call a black man Mr. or to shake hands with him. A young boy growing up 90 miles south in Selma watched white people, complete strangers, children even, call his mother and grandmother by their first names, have the nerve to call out Pearlie to his mother instead of Mrs. Hale, despite their upright bearing and church gloves and finery. Harold Hale came to hate this presumption of overfamiliarity, their putting his high-minded mama and big mama in their place, and worse still, knowing that there was nothing he could do about it. In early 1965, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. came to town. It had been 100 years since the end of the Civil War, and the subordinate caste was still not permitted to vote, despite the 15th Amendment granting that right. Harold Hale signed up for the march Dr. King was planning from Selma to Montgomery. The Edmund Pettus Bridge, that they would have to cross to begin the journey was a few blocks from Hale's house. When he and the 600 other marchers arrived at the foot of the bridge, a column of state troopers in helmets and on horseback blocked their path. The troopers stormed the protesters. They gassed, beat, and trampled them, charging horses, their hooves flashing over the fallen, in the words of the writer George B. Leonard, who watched in horror from his black-and-white television set. ABC News had cut into the middle of Judgment at Nuremberg, a movie about Nazi war crimes, to broadcast the grainy footage from Selma, one nightmare fusing into another. Hale, a teenager far from the leaders up front, was unharmed physically. But he worried now about how long it might take for change to come. He decided then and there that if there was one thing he would do, he would make the dominant caste respect the next generation in his line. He decided he would stand up to the caste system by naming his firstborn daughter, whenever he might be so blessed, Miss. He would give no one in the dominant caste the option but to call her by the title they had denied his foremothers. Miss would be her name. When his firstborn daughter arrived, his wife Linda went along with the plan. Miss was now seated across from me at her lace-covered dinner table one summer evening. The homemade lasagna and strawberry cake had been put away. The kids and her husband were otherwise occupied, and she was recounting her life, north and south, how her father's dreams have brushed up against caste as she moves about the world. A white porcelain sugar bowl sat between us on the table. She swept her hand over the top of the bowl. "I find that white people are fine with me," she said, "as long as I stay in my place, as long as I stay in the container we have built for you." She tapped the side of the sugar bowl, gentle, insistent taps. "As soon as I get out of the container," she said, lifting the lid from its bowl, "it's a problem." She held the lid up to the light and then closed it back in its place. When she was a little girl, her family moved to a small town in East Texas. They were the only black family on their block. Her father took delight in keeping the front yard pristine and tended to it in his off hours. He would change out the annuals in the flower beds overnight so that people would awaken to the surprise of a practically new yard. One day, a white man who lived in the neighborhood saw her father out front mowing the lawn. The man told her father he was doing a mighty fine job and asked what he was charging for yard work. "Oh, I don't charge anything," Harold Hale said. "I get to sleep with the lady of the house." He smiled at the man. "I live here." Once word got out, people took baseball bats and knocked down the mailbox in front of the Hales' carefully tended garden. So Harold Hale set the next mailbox in concrete. One day, someone rolled by and tried to knock it down again from the car window, and when they did, the family heard a yell from outside. "The person had hurt their arm trying to hurl the bat at the new mailbox," Miss said. "But it was in concrete, and the bat kicked back at them." People left the mailbox alone after that. The local high schools began permitting the two castes to go to school together in the early 1970s, before the family had arrived. When she was in 10th grade, she and her friends attracted unexpected attention for the walkie-talkies they used during their breaks between classes. This was before cell phones, and it allowed her to keep in touch with her friends who'd gather at her locker at break time. The principal called her into his office one day, suspicious of the activity, and wanting to know why these people were gathered around her locker. She showed him the device. He asked her name. "Miss Hale," she said.
"What's your first name?"
"It's Miss."
"I said, what is your first name?"
"My name is Miss."
"I don't have time for this foolishness. What's your real name?" She repeated the name her father had given her. The principal was agitated now and told an assistant to get her records. The records confirmed her name. Hale. Hale, he repeated to himself, trying to figure out the origins of this breach in protocol. In small southern towns, the white people knew or expected to know all the black people, the majority of whom would be dependent on the dominant caste for their income or survival one way or the other. He was trying to figure out what black family had had the nerve to name their daughter Miss, knowing the fix it would put the white people in. Hale? I don't know any Hales, he finally said. You're not from around here. Where's your father from? He's from Alabama. Who does he work for? She told him the name of the company, which was based outside of Texas. She told him it was a Fortune 500 company. Her parents had taught her to say this in hopes of giving her some extra protection. I knew you weren't from around here, he said. No, I know. She shook her head, waiting to be excused. You looked me in the eye when I was talking, he said of this breach in caste. Colored folks from around here know better than to do that. She was finally excused, and when she got home that day, she told her father what had happened. He had waited 20 years for this moment. What did he say? And then what did you say? And what did he say after that? He could barely contain himself. The plan was working. He told her over and over that she must live up to the name she was given. They don't have the corner on humanity, he told her. They don't have the corner on femininity. They don't have the corner on everything it means to be a whole, admirable, noble, honorable female member of the species. They haven't cornered that. Years later, Miss had a chance to see life in another part of America. In college, she was invited to spend the summer with the family of a fellow student on Long Island in New York. The family welcomed her and got a kick out of her name and how her family had stuck it to those bigots down south. She was attentive to the grandmother in the family, so the grandmother grew especially fond of her. Miss had a graceful, easygoing manner and was respectful toward the elders in the long tradition of black southern life. When the summer came to a close and it was time to return to school, the grandmother was despondent at her leaving, so attached had she grown to her. I wish you would stay, the matriarch said, looking forlorn and hoping to convince her still. Miss reminded her that she would need to be leaving. There was a time, the matriarch said in warning and regret, when I could have made you stay. She adjusted herself, her voice trailing off at her impotence. Each of us is in a container of some kind. The label signals to the world what is presumed to be inside and what is to be done with it. The label tells you which shelf your container supposedly belongs on. In a caste system, the label is frequently out of sync with the contents, mistakenly put on the wrong shelf, and this hurts people and institutions in ways we may not always know. Back before Amazon and iPhones, I was a national correspondent at the New York Times based in Chicago. I had decided to do a lighthearted piece about Chicago's Magnificent Mile, a prime stretch of Michigan Avenue that had always been the city's showcase. But now, some big names from New York and elsewhere were about to take up residence. I figured New York retailers would be delighted to talk. As I planned the story, I reached out to them for interviews. Everyone I called was thrilled to describe their foray into Chicago and to sit down with the Times. The interviews went as expected until the last one. I had arrived a few minutes early to make sure we could start on time, given the deadline I was facing. The boutique was empty at this quiet hour of the late afternoon. The manager's assistant told me the manager would be arriving soon from another appointment. I told her I didn't mind the wait. I was happy to get another big name in the piece. She went to a back corner as I stood alone in a wide-open showroom. A man in a business suit and overcoat walked in, harried and breathless. From the far corner, she nodded that this was him, so I went up to introduce myself and get started. He was out of breath, had been rushing, coat still on, checking his watch. "Oh, I can't talk with you now," he said, brushing past me. "I'm very, very busy. I'm running late for an appointment." I was confused at first. Might he have made another appointment for the exact same time? Why would he schedule two appointments at once? There was no one else in the boutique but the two of us and his assistant in the back. "I think I'm your appointment," I said. "No, this is a very important appointment with the New York Times," he said, pulling off his coat. "I can't talk with you now. I'll have to talk with you some other time." "But I'm with the New York Times," I told him, pen and notebook in hand. "I talked with you on the phone. I'm the one who made the appointment with you for 4:30. "What's the name?" "Isabel Wilkerson, with the New York Times." "How do I know that?" he shot back, growing impatient. "Look, I said I don't have time to talk with you right now. She'll be here any minute." He looked to the front entrance and again at his watch. "But I am Isabel. We should be having the interview right now." He let out a sigh. "What kind of identification do you have? Do you have a business card?" This was the last interview for the piece, and I had handed them all out by the time I got to him. "I've been interviewing all day," I told him. "I happen to be out of them now." "What about ID? You have a license on you?" "I shouldn't have to show you my license, but here it is." He gave it a cursory look. "You don't have anything that has the New York Times on it." "Why would I be here if I weren't here to interview you?" "All of this time has passed. We've been standing here and no one else has shown up." "She must be running late. I'm going to have to ask you to leave so I can get ready for my appointment." I left and walked back to the Times Bureau, dazed and incensed, trying to figure out what had just happened. This was the first time I'd ever been accused of impersonating myself. His caste notions of who should be doing what in society had so blinded him that he dismissed the idea that the reporter he was anxiously awaiting, excited to talk to, was standing right in front of him. It seemed not to occur to him that a New York Times national correspondent could come in a container such as mine, despite every indication that I was she. The story ran that Sunday. Because I had not been able to interview him, he didn't get a mention. It would have amounted to a nice bit of publicity for him, but the other interviews made it unnecessary in the end. I sent him a clip of the piece, along with the business card that he had asked for. To this day, I won't step inside that retailer. I will not mention the name, not because of censorship or a desire to protect any company's reputation, but because of our cultural tendency to believe that if we just identify the presumed to be rare offending outlier, we will have rooted out the problem. The problem could have happened any place, because the problem is, in fact, at the root.
Context of white supremacy. That is the first audio segment. We'll pick up on chapter 6. The measure of humanity. If you have questions, comments, thoughts, the number to dial is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. press *61 if you would like to participate. We had folks who emailed commentary in, so I'll try to see if I can get all the written commentary in today. First bit of written commentary, untiljustice@gmail.com. I forgot one from last week. One of our investors, he wrote in Chapter 1, The Afterlife of Pathogens. Number 1, anthrax, like the reactivation of the human pathogens of hatred and tribalism in this evolving century, had never died. It lay in wait, sleeping until extreme circumstances brought it to the surface and back to life. I think the more accurate term is racism, white supremacy, as opposed to the terms hatred and tribalism. I often see a similar use of these terms, hatred, tribalism, by suspected racists in the media. Moreover, comparing racism to a dormant pathogen is also inaccurate. The global system of racism, white supremacy has never been dormant. Racists, white supremacists refine their tactics in order to confuse their non-white victims. Number 2, woman Trump supporter. Yes, I know he mouths off at times, she conceded, drawing closer to her potential. Drawing closer to her potential convert, but he will restore our sovereignty. Male golfer, Trump supporter. I remember a time when everybody knew their place. Time we got back to that. White Louisville, Kentucky shooter. Don't shoot me, the shooter told the looker, the onlooker, and I won't shoot you, according to news reports. Whites don't kill whites. The author provided several interesting quotes from suspected racists, which were very revealing. Chapter 2, An Old House and an Infrared Light. America is an old house. It is an old house that should be condemned and rebuilt with a different foundation, a foundation of justice. Number 2, a caste system is an artificial construction, fixed and embedded ranking of human value that sets the presumed supremacy of one group against the presumed inferiority of other groups on the basis of ancestry and often immutable traits, traits that would be neutral in the abstract but are ascribed life and death meaning in a hierarchy favoring the dominant caste whose forebears designed it. A caste system uses rigid, often arbitrary, there's that word again, boundaries to keep the ranked groupings apart, distinct from one another and in their assigned places. I have read this passage several times and still having trouble understanding how the author is distinguishing between caste and race. Understanding this seems so pivotal to the book that I would appreciate others' thoughts on this. Is the global system of racism, white supremacy, just a type of caste system? Question. Number 3, three caste systems stood out, Nazi Germany, India, and United States. A caste system endures because it is often justified as divine will originating from sacred texts or the presumed laws of nature reinforced throughout the culture and passed down through generations. I was surprised that the author did not include South African apartheid. Many examples. 4, caste and race are neither synonymous nor mutually exclusive. They can and do coexist in the same culture and serve to reinforce each other. Race in the United States is the visible agent of the unseen force of caste. Caste is the bones, race the skin. Race is what we can see, the physical traits that have been given arbitrary meaning and become shorthand for who a person is. Caste is the powerful infrastructure that holds each group in its place. Caste is fixed and rigid. Race is fluid and superficial, subject to periodic redefinition to meet the needs of the dominant caste in what is now the United States. The author provides interesting metaphors, but they did not improve my understanding. Is race a characteristic of people used in a caste system? Question. Chapter 3, An American Untouchable. Just as DNA is the code of instructions for cell development, caste is the operating system for economic, political, and social interaction in the United States from the time of its gestation. This is an interesting metaphor, but it still does not help me understand how the author is distinguishing between caste and race. I think the same metaphor could be used for the global system of racism, white supremacy. Number two, Swedish social economist Gunnar Myrdal, Gunnar Myrdal's investigation into race, an American dilemma, the most accurate term to describe the workings of the American society was not race, but caste. It is possible that a suspected racist such as this would find it more advantageous to emphasize caste as opposed to race. Number three, Alex de Tocqueville to observe in 1831, the prejudice of race appears to be stronger in the states that have abolished slavery than in those where it still exists, and nowhere is it so intolerant as in those states where servitude has never been known. De Tocqueville, the suspected racist, is often quoted in American history texts by other suspected racists. True, is de Tocqueville saying that racism is worse in states that did not have slavery? Maybe I am misinterpreting this. This point was raised last week. That's the way it seems to me. The prejudice of race appears to be stronger in states that have abolished slavery than in those where it still exists. That's what it would seem to suggest, that it was worse in the areas where slavery did not exist, whatever that means. It seems to contradict her point because she had just said, like, I think two sentences above that, that racism was worse in the, South. I think one of our callers from last week pointed that out. Anywho, number four, the Dalits, broken people, or untouchables of India are discussed in the text. It is my understanding that in India, even though the population is categorized as one race, the Dalits tend to be darker skinned. I hope the author explores this issue further. We shall see. Number four, upper caste, white, majority, middle caste, Asian or Latino, lower caste, African American, conquered native, Native American. The author lumped a lot of terms together, which was confusing to me. The terms Latino and Asian are very confusing in and of themselves. Adding these other terms seems to only add to the confusion. Number five, the author's speech on race and caste, the Jim Crow era in the American South, the time of naked white supremacy. Another interesting metaphor. I think the author was implying that white supremacy as practiced in the South was more brutal than in the North. I would agree. Number six, Matrix movie metaphor. So too with the caste system as it goes about its work in silence, the string of a puppet master unseen by those whose subconscious it directs its instructions as an intravenous drip to the mind. I think this metaphor deflects attention away from those who are classified as white. Are racist man and woman the puppet masters and non-white victims the puppets? The author does not make this clear. I will stop there. Lots of folks wrote in. This is a new book, just came out this year, so folks are nice and stimulated. That is grand. No tangents, focused on the text. If you weren't able to follow along during the first audio segment, we have another section to go so you can get caught up and participate live time based on what's in the text. Folks who dialed in, if you think you have comments, observations, questions, even one of the folks who wrote in had a few questions, the distinction between caste and race, because she does seem to put a lot of time and emphasis on that, and that this is caste, which is distinct from racism, she even said in the interview. So folks who dialed in, star 61, if you have comments, thoughts to share, line should be open. Let's see.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So I think I'm going to go back a little bit. So from my understanding, the Indian caste system was created by Indo-Aryans. And from my understanding, Indo-Aryans are, I guess, like white people. I think a lot of the Aryan nation, skinheads, like, and also the racial hierarchy of the Indian caste system when it just began with the Dalits, untouchables being at the bottom, which I think they still are at the bottom in the Indian caste system, and that, you know, as you mentioned earlier, they had higher content of melanin in their skin. Not to mention skin lightening is like widespread in India. I found it very interesting. Last week was the Matrix, and then this week, I think she kind of did a metaphor when she was playing it with the word cast and cast like a play, and she went through all these characters and said a bunch of things, and it sounded nice, but I didn't really get why she said all of that. yeah, and then she mentioned something about, like, she brought across this idea as if Germans and Irish and other Europeans, like, it's because they came to America. That's why they became racist white supremacists, even though she didn't use that word, but that's why they wanted to join the dominant caste system, I guess with her language. Yeah, and I want to say, like, Europeans were colonizing and practicing racist white supremacy way before the 1800s when she was talking about when they came here. So how is it that they wouldn't have that ideology even before they came to America? Why would she think that America changed them into something they were not? My last point was when she mentioned the Chicago businessman that she had a meeting with. And she said that he was confused. And when I'm listening to the book, it sounds like she was confused, because he sounds like, you know, he's like, who are you? You know, you are not who I'm supposed to meet with. No, where's your ID? He sounds like a racist white supremacist. And she's the one like, no, why am I being asked these questions? And that's all I have for now. Thank you. And I'm a female. That's it.
Apologies. Didn't hear you clearly, ma'am. My apologies, victim of racism. I will get my ears cleaned out properly for next time around. Other folks who have metaphors are important. Metaphors are important. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Can
I heard both of you. I guess Henry in Chicago, we'll get you first.
All right. Thanks. Greetings, Justin. Greetings to all the callers and listeners. It's interesting. We're reading this book, but also reading Dr. Horn's book, The Dawning of Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism. And I find a lot of, you know, how should I say it, contradictions in the in what she is saying about the early settler colonialism and what Dr. Horn has in his book, because when she goes into the 16th and 17th centuries, it seems, you know, a little different. So, for instance, now one thing she did say is at first religion, not race as we know it, defined the status of people, and Dr. Horn kind of touches on that as well, but she mentions Christianity as a proxy for Europeans, but she doesn't really define, because there were two Christianities. There were Catholicism and Protestantism, and Dr. Horn goes well into that, you know, dynamic and how it morphs into white supremacy. She wrote in this chapter, the colonists have been unable to enslave the native population on its own turf, and believe themselves to be have solved the labor problem with the Africans they imported. Now, according to Dr. Horn, it wasn't the colonists that were able to enslave them. He has a whole chapter where they basically liquidated or exterminated the natives. And so, you know, this is something that is also in contrast to what Dr. Horn has said. The previous caller just also mentioned, too, about how, you know, whiteness became with the Irish and the Scottish when they came to America. But obviously Dr. Horn has made an argument that whiteness was formulated back in the 16th century. So this is, you know, it's pretty interesting, you know, the contrast that it has. But, you know, I know Ms. Wilkerson has footnotes in her book, but Dr. Horn in each chapter has over 100 citation and notes. I mean, his note thing is like 70 pages long. So, and then he's a trained historian, so I guess I'll go along with his argument than Ms. Wilkerson's, even though she is a pretty decent historian. She also mentioned middle caste of Asians, Latinos, and indigenous people. I didn't think indigenous people were middle caste, so you know, I don't know. That was kind of confusing. And the conversation with the Nigerian woman, no black people in Africa. She's a victim, BGQ. But you know, from my experiences of Nigerians or even Africans on the continent who are less confused on racism, they'll give you a distinction of who black people are and who white people are. So, and they'll tell you there are white people on the continent. So that's pretty interesting. And the word caste that she's using, and we touched on this in last week's reading in regards to, being more of a Indian tradition, but then also, you know, touching on medieval Europe, but caste being, you know, of, you know, associated with Indian culture, you know, I was looking at the release date of this book, and it was a week before Kamala Harris was nominated at, selected as, for the run as vice president for Joe Biden. So, you know, with Kamala Harris being half Indian and this book being released, I was just wondering if there was some sort of connection, because you were also mentioning about, you know, white people, you know, pushing back or pushing up the release dates of books. So, you know, I thought about that. And lastly, you know, I'm looking at the language of this book. This book is definitely written for white people, definitely written for the comfort of white people, so they don't have to hear, you know, white supremacy or racism in it. So, but that's all I have in my mind.
Let's see. Two quick things, Henry in Chicago. If you have, like, a hard copy of Caste, or I guess, well, you said the Kindle last week, right? You said you have the Kindle. Is that what you have?
Yes, I have the Kindle version.
Okay. Does your Kindle have footnotes for Caste?
Yes, it has footnotes, but it's not the traditional footnotes. It has, like, quotes, and then it'll give you, like, the reference of where the, you know, where the quotes have, you know, come from.
Okay. I have the ebook version. I actually have two ebook versions, and neither has like the traditional footnotes where you can just like click, and it does have a note section at the end, but mm-hmm. It doesn't have like the, when she mentioned Ian Hani Lopez, it won't have like footnote 43 type thing. You can just go flip back. Like you said, it doesn't have traditional footnotes.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's like on my screen.
Okay. The other quick, when you talked about when this book was released and when Joe Biden selected Kamala Harris as his candidate for VP, are you thinking that might be the way that this book is written? It might be the sort of thing that, hey, there's a relationship between Indian people and black people, and then you have this candidate who identifies as Indian and black, like, hey, that's wow, we do have something in common. Is that the type of relationship that you're seeing?
Yeah, because I know you touched up on, you know, white people pushing back or pushing up release dates, and that's what I saw when I saw the release date of this book.
Mm. very important that we are in, even though it is the year of the Rona, this is an election year, and white people often publish a lot of books around U.S. presidential elections. Cast a ballot. In fact, oh my goodness, just paying attention to the words. So we got cast, cast like a play, but you do cast a ballot. Other folks that we've missed totally, if you have commentary to share.
Hello.
Our silent warrior in Norway, our obligatory time stamp. Let me see. It is 3:32 a.m. Friday morning in Norway. Good to hear from you, sir.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
3 o'clock in the morning, isn't that apt for a religious, like a political reference? I also felt that this book is released at the time in relation to the U.S. Presidential race. I've read some analysis on the web that suggested that Kamala was chosen in December, actually, that she dropped her campaign and started the process of
Kamala Harris's campaign. Let's stay on the book, please.
I got you on the book. I'm sorry. I just woke up 20 minutes ago. I just wanted to join in that commentary between you two. But let me get to the book. So, yes. I think her analysis of the history of race is missing in the beginning of the, on page 42, when she starts to mention Christianity as a proxy for Europeans. I think I feel this book was a bit rushed and could have used a few more years of research. She talks about, she uses this phrase, quarter millennium, which I think is good, but I had to translate. What's a quarter millennium? 250 years. I think it would have been much more accurate if you just said 250 years. That would have been very much more, that would have been a better illustration. However, I think you will see those kind of numbers and figures be used in more traditional books that talk about racism. So it's like someone else could have said, because it's this book might have been written for whites. She has a good line where she says that slavery in this land was created for, by, and for the benefit of the elites in the dominant caste. That was a good line, where she makes an effective contrast that American slavery was legal and sanctioned by the state and a web of enforcers. So even if you managed to escape slavery, you escaped into a world that didn't recognize your freedom, but were returning to your captors. That's however, I thought that was useful. However, on the next page, I wonder why she can't go deeper into European feudal system if she wants to do an effective analysis on racism. When she talks about a peck of corn, that many slaves subsisted on a peck of corn, I did some research on that, and a peck or a peckle is 10 to 14 pounds of corn. In Jamaica, where I'm from, cornmeal is one of the most... A cornmeal porridge made from corn is one of the most ubiquitous. It's a very common breakfast. And children don't really enjoy it, but that's a very common breakfast in Jamaica to this day. And now I realize that that is most likely coming from slavery. I liked this sentence, the most respected and beneficial society people oversaw forced labor camps that were politely called plantations. That's a good sentence. I'll give her props for that. And then this comparison about that, no, where she talks of that we have to wait until the year 2111 for black people in the America to be as to be free as long as they have been enslaved. We have to wait another 91 years for that to happen. I cried when I read that. Okay, but she continues with her confusion in other places. She starts talking about eugenics, and for some reason I kept thinking about the connection between transhumanism and eugenics. She makes a very good point here that white is a political designation that only has meaning when set against something not white. That sounds like it's coming straight out of Nela Fuller. So I thought that was good. I'm like looking for the good things. Okay. Now on page 50, she has another, I see another example where she says one thing and then it is, she has a quote, but then it's contradicted immediately afterwards, where she says that their geographic origin was their passport to the dominant caste, their geographic origin. And she's quoting the Yale historian Jacobson and saying that the European immigrants' experience was shaped by their entering an arena where Europeanness, which is to say whiteness. So already that's contradicting her statement that it is their geographic origin. But the Yale historian is saying it's Europeanness is actually whiteness, skin color. Why does she have to say their geographic origin? That's very strange. Oh, and then the paragraph immediately after that, to gain acceptance, each fresh infusion of immigrants had to enter into a silent, unspoken pact of separating and distancing themselves from the established lowest caste. Is it really unspoken? I mean, I have heard of reports of African immigrants being encouraged not to integrate with African Americans when they immigrate to the U.S. like 10 years ago. Okay, let me see. She talks about when white people practice racism and dehumanize people, that they themselves are being dehumanized. It's an argument I keep hearing, but you don't really see that evidence because when white people practice racism, they are getting benefits. They get to feel superior. They get financial, economic benefits. They're made to feel like they're superhuman. So I'm not sure if I think there's that concept needs to be questioned. I'm like, it is a cousin of the concept that white people are ignorant and are practicing racism because they don't know any better. That concept. When she says none of us are ourselves, I get the feeling that she's running an MLK, Martin Luther King vibe, that, you know, we are all in the same boat. And I just feel like this is something that seems to be necessary for black authors to do, to be accepted when speaking about race. And when she's talking about this, people are putting containers and it hurts the people and the institutions in ways that we may not always know. There aren't any institutions in America that are not formed by race. So the institutions are making the containers. And people are also making the containers. The dominant caste is making the containers. It's just straight up confusion. And then when she talks about this episode with where she's trying to write an article for the New York Times. I think that this, I have 10 seconds. I think that this guy is, he knew, he realized at some point in the exchange with her that she probably is from the New York Times, but he did, he was determined, he most likely was determined to pretend, to keep saying that, no, I don't know who you are. And he would rather lose the article than be corrected by a black woman. Mute my line.
Context of white supremacy. We have heard from other folks, particularly in like a work type setting, which that was, where white people do not like admitting that they made a mistake in front of non-white people. Like, we have heard that lots for workplace racism. Other folks that have commentary that we missed, much obliged, Silent Warrior. Other folks with commentary? I'll check in.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York, yes, sir.
Good evening, Josh. Good evening to the callers. Got a lot of can you hear me? New headset, just want to make sure.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, we got a lot of the white people created slave narrative. Could you imagine white people without Christianity? Yeah. I think look at it that way. With the little bit of morality and stuff they had, could you imagine them? They didn't have that. I mean, they would just be cast. She used a movie or play scenario. I didn't like that, but she made an accurate point, but then she went somewhere else with it. But what was accurate is white people do punish or even kill white people that don't stick to the script. They will get uncasted. I mean, white people don't play any roles. They're not acting. You know, it's not a script. You know, this is real. Just downplays the problem. On the book, though, I thought it was going to be about, well, to have a book called Cast and then try to make it pertain to the relationship between blacks and whites or the lack thereof. It just makes no sense. I thought this was going to be a book explaining how the caste system works amongst white people. You know, white people, how they interact with each other in that, you know, sense of, you know, but we don't have a caste problem with white people. We have a racism problem with white people. It doesn't matter. You know, it's no caste we could get to. That's going to change that scenario, you know, that change that problem, you know, as far as where are you going to make it to? What, you know, how high up do you have to go? The presidency? I mean, it's just not the same thing. And to make it a book about black and white, when you talk about caste, I mean, if you want to talk about the caste within black society or the caste that white people have, I mean, but to make it the same as racism or to kind of tie those things together is very dangerous. Little inconsistency. No place in the world called Germany in 1840. No whites have a common identity as a German as per it being a physical nation until 1871. The people that the white people that they refer to as German, it's because they speak one of the Germanic languages. But these are white people that come from different kingdoms, and they don't get along with each other. They don't speak the same Germanic language. So I thought that was a little bit inaccurate to say they identify as. I mean, that's what white people do, identify as German. I think it has a lot to do with the Hitler thing. The interview piece, I guess her caste was why she couldn't get the interview, not her race. Just very, very confusing to use, you know, the caste. Just from that scenario she gave, if a white woman who he didn't think was a reporter for the New York Times walked in, and I don't see him turning that person away. You know, I just, she might even be from the trailer park and have a trailer park look. But I think that she will have a lot more credentials, you know, even amongst the white cast. You know, it's just totally different. Yeah. She could have went in there with the $100 bottle of Chanel on, the finest clothes, but she was black. You know, it's just totally inaccurate, I think, on the way she's using it. And I had one more point, but I'll save it. Thank you, Gus.
Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. I'm going to read one more person's written commentary, then we'll check on the callers. Other person wrote in, good evening, Gus and the callers. I would like to start by explaining my interpretation of the title. I think the title is meant to create the inclusion of victimization within the system of white supremacy. Next, the framing of the 2016 election, which is how she started the book, it seems that the author is catering to the fear in non-white black people. Also, she is attempting to minimize the role of the Democratic Party in the anti-black war that has, in concert with the Republican Party, has decimated our people. When she spoke about earthquakes and rising plates, it made me think of the rising tide of white supremacy. Well, she mentioned Madison Grant, so lots of parallels. Ignorance is no protection from the consequence of inaction. I like that quote. I agree the timing of this book is suspect, to say the least. I think the purpose is to aid in the class war debate in order to help one political party, India and caste. How interesting. The VP candidate is from Braham, highest caste, and is considered Caucasian, I have been told. White supremacy is uncomfortable to whites. This book is an attempt to make them more comfortable. Lastly, after the brilliant in-depth warmth of Other Suns, this book seems rushed. It seems like it was assigned to her for a purpose. We shall see. Still learning. Me too. Let's see. The Great Buckeye State. Other folks that dialed in, anybody that has commentary on the text that we missed totally? Anybody that we missed completely? Can I be heard? Retired firefighter? Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. I see that the term identified as caste is in the readings this week also. As what I've been hearing, I think it just brings confusion because ultimately you would want to seek after the bottom line of whatever caste that may have existed. It hasn't stopped white people from practicing a global system of racism, white supremacy. Whether the caste was practiced by non-white people and other white people. There was a time, and well, it still is to some extent, a time in history where white people, they call it ethnicities, you know, like the French, the Italians, the Germans, you know, they still have disagreements, squabbles, but at the same time, they, because of a universal white code, they function as one white body over non-white people of the world. That's always been prevalent and in existence since the establishment of racism, white supremacy. I did think it was interesting on some of the, I'm trying to figure out how to term it, some of the distinctions she made historically on how since the, in this part of the world, that's the concept that's called the United States, that since, or America anyway, since that time of quote unquote slavery has not been surpassed, and she gave these dates on when it would come up as even as far as the time that it took for that particular business of racist white supremacy to start and to, as I think she said, when it was abolished, although, you know, from my standpoint, it hasn't been abolished, but from a legal standpoint concerning the white people in this part of the world, that period of time has not been surpassed as of yet. I think she said it would come to equal as far as since 1863, it would come equal in something like, did she say, but 2023, something like that? I thought that was interesting, you know, as far as those historical understandings. And that's it. That's what I've been hearing so far. I haven't had all the time to be paying directly attention, which you probably can tell, but those are the parts that I did have some attention to. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Let's see. I will share a few more notes, share a few of mine, and then we'll get to the second audio segment. And, yes, we'll do our second audio segment for the day. So let's see. I'll start with some of mine. The very beginning. So the subchapter or subtitle for this section of the text, part two, the arbitrary construction of human divisions. And I stopped right there. I looked up the term arbitrary. Arbitrary based on random choice or personal whim rather than any reason or system. And I said, that right there, this book is really bad. And as I read, I said, man, she's lucky that we read The Hate U Give and Nutricide, because I'd be saying, oh, worst book ever. But then I was like, oh, no, it's not that bad. But it is really lame. Very inaccurate understanding of racism, white supremacy. This is not arbitrary. They could have picked foot size, height. She does all of that, ear size, nose size. They picked skin color and a system of mistreatment based on skin color for a reason. That was not arbitrary. I mean, she has arbitrary in all capital letters, boldface print, the arbitrary construction. That's what I mean. When you get somebody who's reading a book with all of this praise that's supposed to explain racism, white supremacy, and it does not do so at all. It just throws you into more confusion. White people publish a lot of books that are inaccurate about racism, and then we just go with the metaphors, a long-running play and The Matrix and the system of white supremacy is a saltine cracker in the wind. So let's see. She says all this about playing roles is inaccurate and nonsense. We're all plays on a stage. That's inaccurate and nonsense. Let's see. She says she's describing the black people in Virginia. She says the ship brought not anything but 20 and odd Negroes, Rolfe wrote, which the governor and Cape Merchant brought for victuals. Now, I was confused at first because I said, are they buying the Negroes to eat them? I was thinking delectable Negro, and then I was like, oh, wait a minute, maybe they traded food for the Negroes. And I said, that would still be delectable Negro, because I know that did happen. That's rumored. I think Frederick Douglass was traded for a barrel of molasses. might be informed about, misinformed about that, but either way, black people and food, tons of those references, just, you know, stay tuned. But wow, they did have a problem with cannibalism. When they started out in the colonialism, they got whole books about that way before Jeffrey Dahmer, so they may have bought the black people to eat them. Delectable Negro. Let's see. Subordinate caste people, like, I would prefer nigger over that. Let's see. The source of inequalities that becloud and stabilize the country to this day, I don't know what that means. Let's see. Delectable Negro again, she says, their efforts to claim full participation in the colonies was in direct opposition to the European hunger for the cheapest, most pliant labor to extract the most wealth from the New World. Then she says, the strengths of the African workers became their undoing. Something bothered me about that. Like, it's not white people being blamed for being sadists and terrorists, racists. It's not that, it's the strength of African workers. Like, somehow it's the victims are still being blamed in this, it seems like. Where it seems like we're going over and beyond to not identify and call out white people in the text. Let's see. And she says it again. We start with arbitrary, and she says it again. In the eyes of the European colonists and to the Africans' tragic disadvantage, they happen to bear an inadvertent birthmark over their entire bodies that should have been nothing more than a neutral variation in human appearance, but which made them stand out from the English and Irish indentured servant. It's not arbitrary at all. And in fact, she goes on, the Europeans could and did escape from their masters and blend into the general white population that was hardening into a single caste, which is what I said before. If you want to talk about a caste or class, whites have constructed one all to themselves. Let's see. She uses the term America and Americans a lot. I have no idea who she's talking about. Are you talking about people in South America? Are you talking about people in the Central, what they call Central Americas? Are you talking about people in Mexico? Are you talking about everybody, white people and non-white people? Sometimes they use Americans and they mean white people. I have no idea who she's talking about. She says, Americans, again, I have no idea who she's talking about, are loath to talk about enslavement. If she's talking about white people, that is a lie. Roots is on television every day. They remake it and remake it. They probably have Diddy in the next version coming out very soon. They have slave books by the billions. They have Harriet Tubman's play and Nat Turner's play, and it's more slave films and flicks than you could possibly watch. Django Unchained, that is a total lie, Isabel Wilkerson, if Americans means white people. Maybe that's not who she's talking about. At least be more clear. She makes another comparison to domestic violence and what have you. Lots of lame metaphors, like, wow, this is a great example. Anybody that starts talking about racism and they just start peppering you with metaphors and analogies, whoa, step back. This is one where I pause. My book doesn't have footnotes. That is like an immediate pause. Anybody that is allegedly writing something serious about racism, white supremacy, and they don't have, like, references, footnotes in the book, ooh, I tend to think this is not very serious. This is just something that is, you know, not going to upset white. What I said last week is going to be palatable to white people, and we're not really going to be addressing this problem in an accurate, serious manner. Lots of goofy footnotes, or excuse me, absence of footnotes in my text, and lots of goofy metaphors, and I mean goofy. And it, I think, was said last week, you know, beating up on non-white authors is not acceptable and not constructive or what have you. No one is beating up on anyone in a book club. This is just sharing views. And if anything, it should be, wow, Gusty Renegade, like she mentioned, Ariella Gross, Ian Hani Lopez, Matthew Fry Jacobson, all of them have been guests on the context of white supremacy. So if anything, it should be, wow, Gusty is super informed to be able to read this book and offer a critique, because I'm even looking at the references like, oh, he was on the program, Ian Hani Lopez. He was not saying dominant cast. In fact, his whole book was about – his book, in fact, is not called Dominant Cast by Law. His book is called White by Law. Excellent. Way better than this book, and gives much more to-the-point information. You can go back in the archives and hear what he had to say. Ariella Gross, she wrote What Blood Won't Tell. She was on the program in 2009. Matthew Fry Jacobson, we read his book about so-called immigrants coming here and transitioning to – he doesn't have in his book the dominant cast is becoming white. In fact, Matthew Fry Jacobson came here to Seattle. We talked to him in person. He wasn't saying dominant cast either. But anywho, you can go back in the archives to hear some of that. We will pause here so we can get to the second audio segment. Wow. Lots of notes, lots of things to chat about in this here text. We will pick up where we left off at. If you have other notes that you did not get to share, just make a note, and we will have time after the second segment is complete. Context of white supremacy, this is Isabel Wilkerson's Cased, The Origins of Our Discontents, audio segment number two.
Chapter 6, The Measure of Humanity. In a parallel universe with laws of nature similar to our own, a conquering people with powerful weaponry journeyed across the oceans and discovered people who looked different from themselves. They were startled to chance upon humans who towered above them, were taller than any humans they had ever seen before. They did not know what to make of this discovery. They had thought of and measured themselves as the standard for human existence. But the indigenous people they saw were at the outer limits of a particular human trait, their height. Even the women averaged over 6 feet. Some of the men approached 7. The well-armed explorers were the opposite. Their weapons were deadly, and their bodies were closer to the ground. At this moment in human history, as the world was being claimed by competing tribes of the well-armed, two peoples who were at the extremes of a highly visible yet arbitrary human characteristic, being tall or short, were confronting each other for the first time. A tribe of the shortest humans were now face to face with the tallest. Those with the most advanced weapons prevailed and found use for the tallest people. They decided to transport them to the new world they were creating. They joined forces with other shorts around the world with whom they made common cause. With their superior guns and stratagems, they conquered the talls, captured and enslaved them for a quarter millennium, and built a great democracy. They told themselves the talls deserved no better, that they were uncultured, backward, inferior, had not made use of their strengths and resources. They were an altogether different species, born to serve the conquerors, deserving of their debasement. They were a separate and subordinate race. This story of conquest sounds preposterous to our ears, not because it did not happen, but because of the seeming absurdity of height as a means of categorizing humanity and determining race. We could have been divided up by any number of other traits, and yet height, like skin pigment, is overwhelmingly an inherited trait, controlled by as much as 80% of one's genes and fairly consistent in family and tribal groupings. As with the pigment of skin, height falls within a wide range among adults in the species, with most people in the middle and with extremes at the poles, from a maximum of 7 feet for adults to a minimum of under 4 feet. Were height the measure for determining race, as arbitrary a measure as any and less arbitrary than some, the Dutch people of the Netherlands would be the same race as the Nilote people of South Sudan or the Tutsis of Rwanda, as they are all among the tallest in our species, even the women averaging well over 6 feet. On the other end, the Pygmies and Sardinians would be their own separate race, as they have historically been among the shortest humans. If current caste behavior were any guide, everyone else would be in the middle, perhaps playing up to whichever height was in power, wearing platform heels if the tall people ruled, bragging that height ran in their families, choosing the tallest people to date and to marry to gain the advantages of the ruling caste. Stereotypes would calcify, as they already do for extremes in height, but magnify to justify the lowly or elevated position of whichever group was in power. In a caste system dominated by short people, anyone in the subordinate race of tall people would be dismissed merely as brawn, consigned to menial, servile positions, seen as good only for entertainment or servitude. Short people would be seen as born to leadership due to their presumed innate intellect and culture, admired for the longevity said to attend people smaller in stature, regarded as the standard of beauty, the default setting for human. Tall people would be made to feel insecure and self-conscious, gangly and unappealing, having been born at the opposite end of the ideal. Society would assume that any tall person was good at sports and physical labor, whether or not he or she had interest or aptitude. Scientists might devise tests to measure the difference between talls and shorts beyond height alone, tests that would largely track the results of generations of either advantage or exclusion, and likely affirm widely held assumptions about the short's inherent supremacy and the tall's misfortune of deficits. There would be few tall people in the boardrooms and corridors of power, and a disproportionate number of them in prisons and on the streets. Being tall would become shorthand for inferior in a caste system ruled by short people, and vice versa. Ludicrous though it may sound to us now, had height been the means of categorizing humans for centuries, as it has been for skin color and facial features, people would have accepted it as the received wisdom of the laws of nature. It would have seemed ridiculous that, in an alternate universe, people would ever be divided by color, given that, clearly, it would have been obvious that height was the determining factor in beauty, intelligence, leadership, and supremacy. The idea of linking disparate groups together on the basis of an arbitrary shared characteristic of being extremely tall or short sounds farcical to us, but only because this characteristic is not the one that has been used to divide humans into seemingly immutable races. The idea of race is a recent phenomenon in human history. It dates to the start of the transatlantic slave trade, and thus to the subsequent caste system that arose from slavery. The word race likely derived from the Spanish word raza, and was originally used to refer to the caste or quality of authentic horses, which are branded with an iron so as to be recognized, wrote the anthropologists Audrey and Brian Smedley. As Europeans explored the world, they began using the word to refer to the new people they encountered. Ultimately, the English in North America developed the most rigid and exclusionist form of race ideology, the Smedleys wrote. Race in the American mind was and is a statement about profound and unbridgeable differences. It conveys the meaning of social distance that cannot be transcended. Geneticists and anthropologists have long seen race as a man-made invention with no basis in science or biology. The 19th century anthropologist Paul Broca tried to use 34 shades of skin color to delineate the races, but could come to no conclusion. If all the humans on the planet were lined up by a single physical trait, say height or color, in ascending or descending order, tallest to shortest, darkest to lightest, it would confound us to choose the line between these arbitrary divisions. One human would blend into the next, and it would be nearly impossible to make the cutoff between, say, the San people of South Africa and the indigenous people along the Marañón River in Peru. who are scientifically measured to be the same color, even though they live thousands of miles apart and do not share the same immediate ancestry. As a window into the random nature of these categories, the use of the term Caucasian to label people descended from Europe is a relatively new and arbitrary practice in human history. The word was not passed down from the ancients, but rather sprang from the mind of a German professor of medicine, Johann Friedrich Blumenbach, in 1795. Blumenbach spent decades studying and measuring human skulls, the foreheads, the jawbones, the eye sockets, in an attempt to classify the varieties of humankind. He coined the term Caucasian on the basis of a favorite skull of his that had come into his possession from the Caucasus Mountains of Russia. To him, the skull was the most beautiful of all that he owned. So he gave the group to which he belonged, the Europeans, the same name as the region that had produced it. That is how people now identified as white got the scientific-sounding, yet random name, Caucasian. More than a century later, in 1914, a citizenship trial was underway in America over whether a Syrian could be a Caucasian and thus white, which led an expert witness in the case to say of Blumenbach's confusing and fateful discovery, "Never has a single head done more harm to science." The epic mapping of the human genome and the quieter, long-dreamt-of results of DNA kits ordered in time for a family reunion have shown us that race, as we have come to know it, is not real. It is a fiction told by modern humans for so long that it has come to be seen as a sacred truth. Two decades ago, analysis of the human genome established that all human beings are 99.9% the same. Race is a social concept, not a scientific one, said J. Craig Venter, the geneticist who ran Celera Genomics when the mapping was completed in 2000. We all evolved in the last 100,000 years from the small number of tribes that migrated out of Africa and colonized the world, which means that an entire racial caste system, the catalyst of hatreds and civil war, was built on what the anthropologist Ashley Montague called an arbitrary and superficial selection of traits derived from a few of the thousands of genes that make up a human being. The idea of race, Montague wrote, was, in fact, the deliberate creation of an exploiting class seeking to maintain and defend its privileges against what was profitably regarded as an inferior caste. We accept the illogic of race because these are the things we have been told. We see a person with skin that is whiter than that of most white people, and we accept that they are not white and thus of a different category, because of the minutest difference in the folds of their eyelids, and because perhaps their great-grandparents were born in Japan. We see a person whose skin is espresso, darker than most black people in America, and accept that he is, in fact, not black, absolutely not black, and is thus a completely separate category, because his hair has a looser curl, and perhaps he was born in Madagascar. We have to be taught this illogic. Small children who have yet to learn the rules will describe people as they see them, not by the political designations of black, white, Asian, or Latino, until adults correct them to use the proper caste designations to make the irrational sound reasoned. Color is a fact. Race is a social construct. We think we see race when we encounter certain physical differences among people, such as skin color, eye shape, and hair texture, the Smedleys wrote. What we actually see are the learned social meanings, the stereotypes that have been linked to those physical features by the ideology of race and the historical legacy it has left us. And yet, observed the historian Nell Irvin Painter, Americans cling to race as the unschooled cling to superstition. The word caste, which has become synonymous with India, did not, it turns out, originate in India. It comes from the Portuguese word casta, a Renaissance-era word for race or breed. The Portuguese, who were among the earliest European traders in South Asia, applied the term to the people of India upon observing Hindu divisions. Thus, a word we now ascribe to India actually arose from Europeans' interpretations of what they saw. It sprang from the Western culture that created America. The Indian concept of rankings, however, goes back millennia and is thousands of years older than the European concept of race. The rankings were originally known as varnas, the ancient term for the major categories in what Indians have in recent centuries called the caste system. The human impulse to create hierarchies runs across societies and cultures, predates the idea of race, and thus is farther reaching, deeper, and older than raw racism and the comparatively new division of humans by skin color. Before Europeans expanded to the New World and collided with people who looked different from themselves, the concept of racism as we know it did not exist in Western culture. "Racism is a modern conception," wrote the historian Dante Puzo, "for prior to the 16th century, there was virtually nothing in the life and thought of the West that can be described as racist." The R word. What we face in our current day is not the classical racism of our forefathers' era, but a mutation of the software that adjusts to the updated needs of the operating system. In the half century since civil rights protests forced the United States into making state-sanctioned discrimination illegal, what Americans consider to be racism has shifted. And now the word is one of the most contentious and misunderstood in American culture. For the dominant caste, the word is radioactive, resented, feared, denied, lobbed back toward anyone who dares to suggest it. Resistance to the word often derails any discussion of the underlying behavior it is meant to describe, thus eroding it of meaning. Social scientists often define racism as the combination of racial bias and systemic power, seeing racism, like sexism, as primarily the action of people or systems with personal or group power over another person or group with less power, as men have power over women, whites over people of color, and the dominant over the subordinate. But over time, racism has often been reduced to a feeling, a character flaw, conflated with prejudice, connected to whether one is a good person or not. It has come to mean overt and declared hatred of a person or group because of the race ascribed to them, a perspective few would ever own up to. While people will admit to or call out sexism or xenophobia and homophobia, people may immediately deflect accusations of racism, saying they don't have a racist bone in their body, or are the least racist person you could ever meet, that they don't see color, that their best friend is black, and they may have even convinced themselves on a conscious level of these things. What does racist mean in an era when even extremists won't admit to it? What is the litmus test for racism? Who is racist in a society where someone can refuse to rent to people of color, arrest brown immigrants en masse, or display a Confederate flag, but not be certified as a racist unless he or she confesses to it or is caught using derogatory signage or slurs? The fixation with smoking out individual racists or sexists can seem a losing battle in which we fool ourselves into thinking we are rooting out injustice by forcing an admission that A, is not likely to come, B, keeps the focus on a single individual rather than the system that created that individual, and C, gives cover for those who, by aiming at others, can present themselves as noble and bias-free for having pointed the finger first, all of which keeps the hierarchy intact. Oddly enough, the instinctive desire to reject the very idea of current discrimination on the basis of a chemical compound in the skin is an unconscious admission of the absurdity of race as a concept. This is not to say that the consequences of this social construct are not real, or that abuses should not be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. It is to say that the word racism may not stand as the only term or the most useful term to describe the phenomena and tensions we experience in our era. Rather than deploying racism as an either-or accusation against an individual, it may be more constructive to focus on derogatory actions that harm a less powerful group, rather than on what is commonly seen as an easily deniable, impossible-to-measure attribute. With no universally agreed-upon definition, we might see racism as a continuum rather than an absolute. We might release ourselves of the purity test of whether someone is or is not racist and exchange that mindset for one that sees people as existing on a scale based on the toxins they have absorbed from the polluted and inescapable air of social instruction we receive from childhood. Caste, on the other hand, predates the notion of race and has survived the era of formal state-sponsored racism that had long been openly practiced in the mainstream. The modern-day version of easily deniable racism may be able to cloak the invisible structure that created and maintains hierarchy and inequality. But caste does not allow us to ignore structure. Caste is structure. Caste is ranking. Caste is the boundaries that reinforce the fixed assignments based upon what people look like. Caste is a living, breathing entity. It is like a corporation that seeks to sustain itself at all costs. To achieve a truly egalitarian world requires looking deeper than what we think we see. We cannot win against a hologram. Caste is the granting or withholding of respect, status, honor, attention, privileges, resources, benefit of the doubt, and human kindness to someone on the basis of their perceived rank or standing in the hierarchy. Caste pushes back against an African-American woman who, without humor or apology, takes a seat at the head of the table speaking Russian. It prefers an Asian American man to put his technological expertise at the service of the company, but not aspire to CEO. Yet it sees as logical a 16-year-old white teenager serving as store manager over employees from the subordinate caste three times his age. Caste is insidious and therefore powerful because it is not hatred. It is not necessarily personal. It is the worn grooves of comforting routines and unthinking expectations, patterns of a social order that have been in place for so long that it looks like the natural order of things. What is the difference between racism and casteism? Because caste and race are interwoven in America, it can be hard to separate the two. Any action or institution that mocks, harms, assumes or attaches inferiority or stereotype on the basis of the social construct of race can be considered racism. Any action or structure that seeks to limit, hold back, or put someone in a defined ranking seeks to keep someone in their place by elevating or denigrating that person on the basis of their perceived category can be seen as casteism. Casteism is the investment in keeping the hierarchy as it is in order to maintain your own ranking, advantage, privilege, or to elevate yourself above others or keep others beneath you. For those in the marginalized castes, casteism can mean seeking to keep those on your disfavored rung from gaining on you, to curry the favor and remain in the good graces of the dominant caste, all of which serve to keep the structure intact. In the United States, racism and casteism frequently occur at the same time, or overlap, or figure into the same scenario. Casteism is about positioning and restricting those positions vis-a-vis others. What race and its precursor racism do extraordinarily well is to confuse and distract from the underlying structural and more powerful Sith Lord of caste. Like the cast on a broken arm, like the cast in a play, a caste system holds everyone in a fixed place. For this reason, many people, including those we might see as good and kind people, could be casteist, meaning invested in keeping the hierarchy as it is or content to do nothing to change it, but not racist in the classical sense, not active and openly hateful of this or that group. Actual racists, actual haters would by definition be casteist, as their hatred demands that those they perceive as beneath them know and keep their place in the hierarchy. In everyday terms, it is not racism that prompts a white shopper in a clothing store to go up to a random black or brown person who is also shopping and to ask for a sweater in a different size, or for a white guest at a party to ask a black or brown person who is also a guest to fetch them a drink, as happened to Barack Obama as a state senator, or even perhaps a judge to sentence a subordinate caste person for an offense for which a dominant caste person might not even be charged. It is caste, or rather the policing of and adherence to the caste system. It's the autonomic, unconscious, reflexive response to expectations from 1,000 imaging inputs and neurological societal downloads that affix people to certain roles based upon what they look like and what they historically have been assigned to or the characteristics and stereotypes by which they have been categorized. No ethnic or racial category is immune to the messaging we all receive about the hierarchy, and thus no one escapes its consequences. What some people call racism could be seen as merely one manifestation of the degree to which we have internalized the larger American caste system, a measure of how much we ascribe to it and how deeply we uphold it, act upon it, and enforce it, often unconsciously in our daily lives. When we assume that the woman is not equipped to lead the meeting, or the company, or the country, or that a person of color or an immigrant could not be the one in authority, is not a resident of a certain community, could not have attended a particular school, or deserved to have attended a particular school, when we feel a pang of shock and resentment, a personal wounding and sense of unfairness, and perhaps even shame at our discomfort upon seeing someone from a marginalized group in a job or car or house or college or appointment more prestigious than we have been led to expect, when we assume that the senior citizen should be playing Parcheesi rather than developing software, we are reflecting the efficient encoding of caste, the subconscious recognition that the person has stepped out of his or her assumed place in our society. We are responding to our embedded instructions of who should be where and who should be doing what, the breaching of the structure and boundaries that are the hallmarks of caste. Race and caste are not the cause and do not account for every poor outcome or unpleasant encounter. But caste becomes a factor to whatever infinitesimal degree in interactions and decisions across gender, ethnicity, race, immigrant status, sexual orientation, age, or religion that have consequences in our everyday lives and in policies that affect our country and beyond. It may not be as all-consuming as its targets may perceive it to be, but neither is it the ancient relic, the long-ago anachronism that post-racialists, post-haters of everything, keep wishing away. Its invisibility is what gives it power and longevity. Caste, along with its faithful servant race, is an X factor in most any American equation. And any answer one might ever come up with to address our current challenges is flawed without it.
All right. Just making sure I looked at that correctly. So unless I'm mistaken, anachronism, Cal's word, we have a few of them. Necrophilia is another one. Anachronism or anachronistic has come up in two consecutive books. I think Romaine Gary used anachronistic in White Dog, and then Isabel Wilkerson just said it here. It may not be as all-consuming as its targets may perceive it to be, but neither is it the ancient relic, the long-ago anachronism that post-racialists, post-haters of everything keep wishing away. That is a word we have used a few times on the program. That being said, I will say it again. She, Isabel Wilkerson, is fortunate. We have already read The Hate U Give, Nutricide this year. If it weren't, this book would be in the running for one of the worst I have ever read. It just keeps getting worse and worse as we, I even had to pause a few times like, did she just say it? Like, wow, it is even more stunning, like the same person who wrote The Warmth of Other Suns wrote this. Woo! Absolute disgrace, and I have no problem saying that because people go out and spend money on books like that, especially someone we've read on the Cows before in top 10. Not this one. Not a plug nickel would I spend on this book. If I spent any money on it, I would want a refund. Rubbish. The only reason it can't be in the worst ever category, The Hate U Give was that bad. Nutricide was that bad. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I talk about metaphors all the time, and have anyone that's been listening to the Cows, this is not a recent thing. Gus has been, you know, saying something about metaphors and analogies for years. So we're allegedly reading a book about caste, racism. She says, really long sentence, a personal wounding and sense of unfairness and perhaps even shame at our discomfort upon seeing someone from a marginalized group, that word, in a job or car or house or college or appointment more prestigious than we have been led to expect, when we assume that the senior citizen should be playing Parcheesi rather than developing software, we are reflecting the efficient encoding of caste. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. We started this here text. We were talking about terror, slavery, torture of black people who named their children Miss because white people would not call them by their correct name. That was what we started off talking about. Now somehow we have switched over to senior citizens. If we see them playing Parcheesi, that is somehow, or if we see them, we think they're supposed to be playing shuffleboard or Parcheesi as opposed to developing Matrix number 5, working on a new operating system for my computer. Wait a minute. wait a minute. I didn't think The Warmth of Other Suns, which is allegedly what spawned this book, I didn't think that that was about just general marginalization. I thought that was about racism and black people specifically being mistreated. I thought that's what that book was about. Maybe I'm confused. I will stop there. Extra, extra lame. Wow, so disappointing. If you have commentary to share, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Please do not wait till the last. Ooh, had to sneeze. Excuse me. Please do not wait till the last minute. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yeah. Heard both of you. I'll get Thomas in New York first.
Thank you. I heard social distancing in the reading, and I said, man, this was written very recently. Something that just stands out now, but it's something that you didn't hear before quite often. The caller earlier made a great point about the Democratic Party. Her anti-Trump rhetoric earlier in the book, and then going on to talk about slavery, the abuse that we dealt with after slavery, Civil War, even mentioning the Confederate flag last reading, not the American United States flag, but leaving out the Democrats. And how can you have a conversation about slavery and the abuse after slavery, the Civil War, and not talk about the Democrats? It would put them in a very bad light or in a very bad, give them a bad look. I think that was glossed, just left out altogether on purpose. She said race isn't real. Says who? You know, if it isn't real, then why is it happening? You know, it's dangerous to make the point against racism, in my opinion. With the race is not real, it was made up by white people based on a skull, or the word Caucasian is modern and using that as your basis, but that's not the reality. It's so real, I could point out a million instances where it happens every day. Like, what are you talking about? So, I think it's important to make the point about how these sciences are flawed. In particular, the scientists that made these things up, if they were basing their whole theory on race, then it's a fake theory. But to say that's the reason why it's not real and it's happening, I think it's dangerous. She mixed race with caste several times, which I think is wrong. She did the black and brown again. Then this reading, she said racism and sexism in the same. Those are not the same thing. None of those things are the same. Like, let's not use racism anymore because white people deny its existence. We should use something else, something they're more comfortable with, it sounds like. Caste, is a structure and ranking. See, the context that she uses caste in the reading, caste is natural. You know, it just happens. It's normal. It's natural. But it's no way anyone can say racism is natural. It's a man-made. It's an art. You know, man had to sit down and work on this and get it to where it is. So, once again, another bad reason why you shouldn't mix those two things together. The caste builds in and everything in nature. Every animal has a caste. Every group of people has a caste in it. But the racism is not natural. That's something that someone had to be taught and master and, tested out, I'm sure, along the way. I'm in my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. I think it's Henry. Oh, just a quick correction. She does use the term social distancing in this book. We are going to hear it, but we have not heard it yet. In this chapter, she said separating and distancing themselves. However, she is going to use the term social distancing in this book. So, yes, at least parts of it had to be written very, very recently. I think that was Henry in Chicago.
The metaphors that she's using first of all, she's using too many, and the metaphor she's using is just totally out of context. The tall description thing that she used in the beginning of the chapter, it just didn't resonate with me in regards to what she's trying to get at. She also used a mutation of the software that adjusts to the updated needs of the operating system. I have an undergraduate degree in computer science, and I'm not sure if software mutates, software updates, but I never heard software mutating. So that was pretty weird. But you know what I've been trying to get at, and you know, reading along with this book is she intentionally trying to confuse us? Or I mean, I'm just going to go with the fact that she's a confused victim, just like we all are, BGQ. But it's just with this thing of caste and race, it seems like she's trying to pull apart. Well, first of all, I'm not sure if she uses race as racism as a system, and I'm believing that she's trying to pull apart the system of racism away from, you know, racism. Like, racism is some sort of abstract thing, you know, and the caste is a concrete thing. That's where the power lies. And this, I think that's what she's trying to get at here, and I'm not sure it's working, you know, or even believable. But you know, I just don't feel like caste is supposed to be the most powerful system on earth, and then you know, racism and sexism kind of fall, because I think in the reading she called racism caste's child, and that's a very confusing metaphor. I don't know if there were any white editors that did this or changed this. Apparently she approved of this, but yes, I'm not sure if she's intentionally doing this because of the election. I just think in my last commentary, you know, she is definitely writing this for white people and to make white people feel comfortable. So that's all I have under my line.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. I think someone says, if you don't understand racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works, everything else that you understand will only confuse you. Trying to minimize confusion. Folks that we missed totally, do you have commentary?
May I speak?
Silent Warrior with us, 4:44 a.m. Friday morning.
Thank you. So, and thank you for today's podcast. This chapter's title tells you it's called The Measure of Humanity. Humanity. So that's awesome. We are all one. Kumbaya. That kind of sets you up for what's happening in the chapter. She says we could have been divided by any number of other traits. Okay, she's recognizing skin color. Good. Why not investigate further why skin color is prioritized? She's making a good observation there, but she doesn't investigate further. I thought it was useful information that race came from the Spanish word raza. I hadn't seen that before. That is good. That felt like a Wilson moment, especially when you connect it to racing horses. Moving on, this point that she makes about Asians having skin that are whiter, that is whiter than white people. Again, it kind of shows you that
probably that's a great opportunity. That's something I hadn't seen, not even with Wilson, and it makes the point that this thing about white skin is about genetic dominance, that these other non-whites dominance. So even though Asians might seem to have white skin, they are genetically dominant to people who are classified as white. So I thought that that helped me to think about Dr. Wilson's work. She makes the statement, color is a fact. Race is a social construct. Wow. So why not investigate color? And why not investigate the color confrontation theory? I really would love to know if she has read Dr. Wilson's work. With all of this, it feels as if someone who is, she's in the room right beside the room that has the Wilson's papers, but she doesn't, she's so close, but so far away. I feel like her analysis about Indian history, it needed more data, more information. She should probably do a little bit more reading, because the connection with Aryans and skin whiteness and how they enforce the caste system after their invasion of India is not mentioned. Now, the R word, when she talks about racism being contentious and misunderstood, and how racists, the extremists will not admit to it. She uses the words, what does racist mean in an era when even extremists won't admit to it? So who are these extremists? They're racists. And is that so odd? And is it really, this is the era that racists won't admit to it? Wasn't that happening in the 20s as well? Okay. But isn't this just standard tactics by a dominant caste to maintain dominance? Why can't it be thought of in that way? Now, she's expressing the frustration of, I understand, of non-whites who have been working against racism, like how we can't get them to admit that they're racist. I feel at this point, Fuller is needed. Fuller's compensatory code is really needed. And I can see, okay, she's making this book as an attempt to, probably she's making this book as an attempt to help non-whites solve the race problem. But why not just improve the definition of racism or delve deeper into critical race theory? Here's a confusing statement. She says, caste, on the other hand, predates the notion of race and has survived the era of formal state-sponsored racism that had long been practiced openly in the mainstream. If it predates it, I felt a bit confused. How can caste predate it then in the States? I think she's mixed, confusing India and the United States there. And as she goes further, she says one thing that's really useful. Caste is structure. Caste is ranking. Caste is the boundaries that reinforce the fixed assignments that, based on what people look like. All great. That's the benefit, I think, of her using this word or this concept. That's the only benefit I see. But immediately after you start to lose the value of this concept. Because it seems to be that she wants to speak about racism without focusing on racist white people. Instead of using racism, you can use caste. Instead of using white people, you can use dominant caste. And if you're not careful, you can end up saying that there are people in a dominant caste over other people that are not white. I'm a big concern that this will be a way to help white people practice racism, and they can say, I'm not being racist, I'm caught up in the dominant caste. There's more confusion. And for that, I came up with a question that we can ask her. Can you give an example of casteism in the U.S. that is not based in racism, white supremacy? Can you give an example of casteism in the U.S. that is not based in racism, white supremacy. Because if you can't do that, then you don't really need this concept. So that's my tool that I'll be using further in the book. And then finally, you at the end of the chapter, you see that this caste concept becomes a meta concept in itself, where the dominant concept is caste and the less dominant concept is race. So racism becomes subordinate to her concept of caste. I mean, like, in one book. No. No. Caste along with its favorite, along with its faithful servant race. Just feels a bit silly. In my copy of the book, Gus, I have a bunch. She has lots of references per chapter with the books that she's referring to and so on, and with some text about what she meant. So she's got her references, but I think she could have used a couple more years on this. Thank you very much for the time.
Much obliged, Silent Warrior. Were there any books that we missed? Anybody?
Can I be heard?
Sir.
Yes, ma'am. We'll get our female caller first.
Yeah.
Thank you. When I was listening to this book, I was wondering, like, why? Why did she write the book? I couldn't understand why she wrote the book. When she was the shorts and the talls, and saying, you know, like, in an alternate universe, I'm like, why are we going into an alternate universe? You're talking about caste system. You said that, you know, we're talking about the Indian caste system and that American, and, you know, like, why are we going into an alternate universe? Or why are we not staying in reality? What else? I heard the word arbitrary came up, like, more than once. And I also think that this idea that even though race is, let's say, for instance, race is not real, that means that there's not a system of racism and white supremacy because there's no scientific thing for race. I think that's dangerous. I think this book is very dangerous. I think it's very misleading. I think it's misinformation. At one point in the book, she mentioned that white supremacy was not in the West. And it's like, yeah, because, yeah, white supremacy, you need to have white people to have white supremacy. So, yeah, that's, like, common sense. Yeah, and then she mentioned, interestingly, about how casta, you know, caste come from the Portuguese word for casta, and casta means race. And then she said how the Portuguese, and even the way she described the Portuguese, labeling the Indians, but yet still she tries to distance caste from race when the actual basis of the word is race. What else? And then I see her like mixing in sexism, ageism, and all these isms in. It's just like, it's a very confusing book, and I'm really wondering, like, you know, like, why did she write this book? And I feel like it's a book that's advocating, like, compassion for white people because, you know, they're just caught up in this system, and it reminds me of this thing that I think you might speak about, the systemic racism, where there's not actually white people who are practicing racism, but it's just something in some kind of machine. I think that's it for now. Thanks for letting me share.
Yes, ma'am. Much obliged. Retired firefighter, thanks for your patience, sir.
Yes, sir. In the beginning, I thought it was a Jane Elliott moment when I was hearing her make some sort of distinction with tall people and short people. That sort of thing. Reminds me of the theoretical experimentations that racial suspect Jane Elliott has been known to practice which I think I've heard said that what it promotes is to make white people become a little smarter on the practicing of racism and white supremacy. I'm beginning to think in itself that this idea of casteism rivaling with the global system of racism, white supremacy is just another effort to further confuse non-white people, primarily, of the global system of racism, white supremacy. So far, it's being more and more consistent based on each chapter that we read in each reading session that we have. And I don't think it's going to change, you know, with the book itself. I don't think it's going to change. That's my report. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Did we nab everybody who dialed in with a hand up?
I have a quick question. Did she say the word casteless?
Casteless?
No, casteless, like racist, but casteless.
Oh, casteless. I think she did. Let me double check. I think she did. I know she said casteism, and she had a few different derivatives of the term. Let's see. Maybe she didn't. Maybe she didn't. I have to double check. Maybe she didn't. I thought I, unless okay. I am misspelling it, which I guess could be, but case this. Maybe she didn't. She did say casteism. I did see casteism, but not case this. I will double check after we wrap up to make sure. But if I had to, just based on my quick searches here, I would say no. At least I didn't find it. Let's see. I did want to make sure I got in as well. It was said that she wrote this book to help non-white people solve the problem of racism. I don't know if that is true. I have concluded that not all of the white people or even non-white people who talk about racism are sincerely trying to solve the problem. And I've concluded this because some of these people have told me that they're not trying to solve the problem, that in fact that they don't even think this problem can be solved, even though they talk about it. So because of that, and I've heard that more than once, I don't make that assumption, and particularly when I read a book that is not very accurate, oh, man, yeah, I don't know. Maybe she did, maybe she didn't. I know it's not very accurate, and I would tend to think that books that are not accurate are not going to help solve this problem. The word arbitrary was in chapter 6 many, many times. I almost stopped to see how many times is the word arbitrary going to be in this book, and that's just more confusion because this being about skin color is not arbitrary. She uses we a lot. Who are you talking about? Like, this is we accept the illogic of race because these are the things we have been told. Told by whom? Let's see. When people use the term the historical legacy, that's another one where I point to inaccuracy because it diminishes the fact that white supremacy racism is being conducted right now. Let's see, it's 5 a.m. in Norway, Silent Warrior. It's being conducted right now, not historically, not because of vestiges of slavery and all that other tacky verbiage. No, because white people right now are dedicated to the system of racism, and there's a lot of effort to push away from saying that. She references Nell Irvin Painter again, guest on The Cows, 2010, and that would be a cowbell as well. We talked about her book,
the history of white people. And she quotes the tackiest line from Nell Irvin Painter's book, "Americans cling to race as the unschooled cling to superstitions." She wrote the history of white people. I guess a lot. She even Blumenbach and all these folks and talking about the history of raping children and homophobia and homophobic culture, homoerotic culture. We talked about all that in detail with her 2010. It's a lot better quotes that she could have taken. She's a noted historian. Let's see. A lot of this, too, just seems like what I said last week, an effort to talk about racism in a manner that is palatable to white people. It does not make sense to me to not use the word racism. Just because she doesn't even say white people, because the dominant caste become upset about it. That does not strike me as a reason to not use the term. Maybe it should be used more if a dominant caste is bothered about this term. Let's see. She compares it to sexism at some point, and then she doesn't. That's why I said the metaphors are just, man, really lame book. Minimizing white people's dedication to white supremacy racism. She said, she doesn't even say white people, with no universally agreed upon definition, which is true. That just means you make your own definition because there's no universally agreed upon definition for many, many words, including justice. We might release ourselves of the purity test of whether someone is or is not a racist and exchange that mindset for one that sees people, everybody, as existing on a scale based on the toxins they have absorbed from the polluted and inescapable air of social instruction we receive from childhood. We. You have racist white supremacists who are taught to be racist from day one, and we're watching, you know, Good Times and Tyler Perry. And we all receive the same instructions about the play we are in. This is nonsense, like nonsense of the high. It is only because we read Nutricide, The Hate U Give, this here book would be in the running for the worst ever. It is just, I just have to keep saying it's really lame to say that as we continue throughout the text. We'll stop there for the day. And with what was said about the timing of when this book was published, I'm going beyond that because white people, powerful white people, published this book. Maybe they intended to be really lame to confuse non-white people. We'll pick up next week and continue, not hoping for improvement. We'll be here for Neutralizing Workplace Racism tomorrow, Compensatory Call-In on Saturday, and Global Sunday Talk on Racism this Sunday. Well, we generally emphasize global. That's another major point. It's not the American caste system. This is the global system of white supremacy. I guess my final point I'll get in, that first anecdote about Nigeria, this non-white person that she talked to, like, I just thought that was so absurd. We've read, like, Madiba. Did Madiba sound like he was talking that there's no black people on the continent? Is that what Madiba sound like? When we read Chinua Achebe? The education of a British protected child, did he sound like there were no black people on the continent? I thought they were having Black Lives Matter protests on the continent right now. Maybe all that is just ignorant. I would skip all of that. Forget, maybe they don't have black. I think the word kafir does exist over there, right? Maybe they don't have all that. Fine. Do you know about the white man? We read Dreams from My Father. I think he talked about how white people were treated. She talked about President Obama. I think they talked about how white people were treated in Kenya. They weren't treated like Negroes or Kaffirs. He had a big section talking about how white people were treated in Kenya. I think they know about the white man. Anywhere, Egypt, Cairo to Cape Town, I think they know about the white man. Super lame book. She's lucky we read The Hate U Give, Nutricide. Much obliged for the folks who participated. Hope it's been worthy of your time and energy, even though it's a really lame book. Sobriety would be best. We need our brain computer functioning at maximum capacity. Lots of problems, difficulties from the dominant caste. In addition to being sober, I would say stay in the house. Whites, I mean, man, the toxins in the air alone. If you are not on the West Coast, bravo for you. You have fresh air. No idea when we will have fresh air. You can't even open the windows in the house. We'll watch the end of summer. We'll have to conclude with the windows and blinds closed. That's their recommendation. So there are many reasons to not be outside right now, depending on where you are. If you're in the U.S., many of the dominant cast members are armed and have been really volatile this year. So if you are going to go out, I would be very mindful, very alert. If it looks like anyone is becoming hostile, loud, time to exit. White people have a history of terrorizing black people. She did get that in this week. If you got to go out, something essential, you are buckled, you are sober. If you are driving or even passenger, you are buckled up, as I said. If you're driving, you are not on the cell phone. We need all of our attention. Keep our eyes on what's happening around us. And we are minimizing contact with race soldiers, badge or no. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. A victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.